From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Guerlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Syria comment blogger Joshua Landis joins us for analysis of President Bashar al-Assad's interview this week with the BBC. And Rebecca Cruz will discuss German Chancellor Angela Merkel's visit with President Obama and what they're trying to accomplish regarding Ukraine.
The United States has on the table right now the option of weapons to the Ukrainian government in the hopes that they would push the separatists and Russians out.
Then Rebecca talks with Catherine Bolkovac, who sued her employers for unfair dismissal after she lost her job for trying to expose sex trafficking in Bosnia.
Many times mission officials would come into the internal affairs office and physically pull the files and the cases and just make them disappear.
Sex trafficking, military contractors, and one woman's fight for justice. But first, this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlot. Joshua Landis and Rebecca Cruz. Let's look first at Syria, Joshua. We need to do an update here because Syrian President Bashar al-Assad was in the news this week, and President Obama was in the news as well, asking Congress to authorize the use of military force in Syria.
It's barbaric murders of so many people, including American hostages, are a desperate and revolting attempt to strike fear in the hearts of people. It can never possibly win over by its ideas or its ideology because it offers nothing but misery and death and destruction. And with vile groups like this, there is only one option. With our allies and partners, we are going to degrade and ultimately destroy this terrorist group.
We're about to hit the fourth anniversary of the conflict in Syria. 200,000 dead, 3 million refugees, you know, 7, 8 million internally displaced people. But, you know, Assad comes across as very casual, as kind of nonchalant, rather smug about it in some ways.
As long as the government and the state institutions fulfilling its duty toward the Syrian people, we cannot talk about failed states.
So lay this out for us. Assad's won. He's on the back burner. We don't even think about him. He's able to come now and do an international interview, you know, and be very cavalier about the conflict. And then President Obama and others now shifting their attention away from Assad and onto ISIS.
Well, you're absolutely right. Assad does feel a sense of confidence. He is giving these interviews to the West for the first time in years because he's hoping to become a partner with the United States, that the United States will, in a sense, do what they're doing in Iraq, which is team up with the national government to reconquer this territory that's been taken away by ISIS. We're going to do that in Iraq because the Shiite government there was built by the United States and is 60% of the population. But Assad's government, the Alawites, the Shiites there are only about 15%. And they've killed so many people, as you said. And his – this just sounds barbaric. And the United States is not going to team up with Assad.
So I was going to say, that how realistic is that? If that's what Assad's trying to do, is to partner with us to defeat ISIS, his enemy too. But that's not very realistic. Like you said, we're not going to team up. But yet we both have the same objective here.
He did say that he was being notified when the United States was going to fly bombing missions. No tactical details, but the United States doesn't want to be get in the way of Syria and doesn't want to have Syria turn on its radar. So there is a level of cooperation. They are strategic allies because they both have the same enemy. And Assad wants to become closer allies. The United States does not. But this underlines the real problem with the president going to Congress and asking for this War Powers Act.
Is it likely to be approved? Do you think Congress is going to approve?
I do. I do think they will. They don't have much choice. But I think underlying this is it shows that we do not have a partner in Syria. We're not going to team up with the government as we're doing in Iraq. And Turkey, the big neighbor to the north that's got a 500-mile border with ISIS, we just learned the other day from an ISIS defector that Turkey had allowed a column of troops from ISIS to go through Turkey to attack the Kurds. In a sense, we're following diametrically opposed policies. We are arming up the Kurds to attack ISIS, and Turkey has been using ISIS to attack the Kurds. So we're not on the same page. We don't have good partners, and that means pursuing a policy of containment, not of destruction.
Well, we'll be paying attention to that relationship with Turkey. I'm sure we'll be talking about that in the future. All right. So, Rebecca, the German Chancellor Angela Merkel visited President Obama this week in Washington to argue that there is no military solution to the conflict in Ukraine. There's no military option to stop Russian President Vladimir Putin from taking Ukraine, basically. You know, that the concern is that we're going to accidentally end up in some sort of major European war, once again, World War III, if you will. But if he isn't stopped there, is he unstoppable? Is this just the Germans that feel this way? Is this a European sentiment? And where does the U.S. come down on this?
Well, that's very much the concern, of course, is when will he stop? Angela Merkel was in D.C. this week talking with President Obama, and they were discussing this in great detail. They held a press conference in which they came out and seemed to show unity, explained what great partners they were. Obama was calling her Angela. They seem to be on the same page. But underlining that is some tension that Germany, France, and some of the other European partners have very much been pushing for more diplomatic means and really trying to exhaust all diplomatic purposes, whereas the United States has kind of on the table right now the option of providing lethal weapons to the Ukrainian government in the hopes that they would push the separatists and Russians out. But as you say, there is a lot of concern that this will lead to further escalation, and it's not likely to be enough to get Putin to backtrack. But we have seen some positive results this week, or potentially positive, because before she came to Washington, Chancellor Merkel and French President Hollande were actually in Moscow helping to formulate a proposed peace plan, which was just signed on Thursday. It includes a ceasefire that will go into effect on Sunday, along with some other stipulations, what we might call a bailout or a large chunk of money that would go to help rebuild Ukraine and some other things. But the ceasefire is the most important, and then a buffer zone that would help get rid of some of the larger weapons. So we'll see if this will work out. We've, of course, seen these plans before, but having these European partners involved, having Putin and his team involved, as well as the Ukrainian president, seems to suggest that hopefully, just maybe, this will be more successful.
Any suggestion that the territory in the eastern part of Ukraine would remain part of Russia or Ukraine?
Well, the suggestion is that they would have some sense of autonomy, that they would be included then in the redrafting of a new Ukrainian constitution, that they would perhaps still be within Ukraine, but would get to determine what that constitution would look like. So we'll see how that plays out as well.
All right. Well, as always, thank you both for being here.
Great to be with you.
Thank you.
If you have any thoughts about this conversation, let us know by leaving your questions and comments in the Worldview section of our website. We also welcome your feedback on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU, at Suzette Guerlot, at Cruz226, and at Joshua_Landis. You can also subscribe to our podcast and download this show from iTunes and read transcripts and recaps of all of our interviews at KGOU.org. I'm Suzette Guerlot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlot. While working as a United Nations contractor in Bosnia in the late 1990s and early 2000s, Catherine Bulkovac discovered her fellow international police force officers were paying for underage prostitutes and participating in sex trafficking. She lost her job after trying to bring the activities to light and won her lawsuit against the British contractor DynCorp in 2002. In 2010, her story was made into a film called The Whistleblower. Catherine Bulkovac spoke with our contributor, Rebecca Cruz.
Catherine Bulkovac, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, we're very excited to have you here because you have a very interesting story, a very interesting life experience that has shaped you. And I was hoping that we could just start off by talking about that story. You were originally from Nebraska, so not too far from Oklahoma. You worked as a police investigator for a number of years. And then in the late 1990s, you headed to Bosnia working for a military or security contractor as Bosnia was going through the initial phases of reconciliation. And maybe that's where we could pick up. What was your experience there when you first got there? And what happened to you when you were there? Or what did you witness?
Sure. Well, when I arrived, I actually became, first of all, acquainted with the entire UN structure and how things actually work under this UN umbrella. And the government contractor that I was working with were not actually security contractors. They were part of the military contingent force, the International Police Task Force, which was seconded to the United Nations. So it was very much a dysfunctional kind of piece of organizational lineage that I had to cross. I had to report both to the United Nations, to this U.S. government contractor, as well as to the Office of Human Rights, where I worked as a human rights investigator. And initially, the first 3 or 4 months, it became quite clear that when I was there, that there was a lot of strip bars, sexual activity going on with prostitution and nightclubs, which many of the internationals were visiting and taking part in, which very much bothered me from the beginning. There was very little control and lack of accountability going on, especially off military bases where most of the military contractors were. They had to find their own housing in the local communities of the people we were there to try and help. So it was a very difficult situation to go through and very confusing for the most part. And then eventually I was, after being a human rights investigator for about 3 months, I was given a special project to work on in a town about 70 kilometers north of Sarajevo. And that's when I first had the first human trafficking victim come to me at that time. And, of course, back in the late 1990s, no one was talking about human trafficking. That term really wasn't even heard, at least locally. There was some talk of it internationally. And the case that I worked was a girl that had escaped from a local bar up in the hills around the city. And that ultimately turned into kind of a snowball effect, whereas over the next year, year and a half, I had worked over 100 cases while I was there myself who came through the offices.
And so these were women who had been trafficked from outside of the Western Balkan region, and they were being trafficked and used by international officials that were there to assist the people of Bosnia as they went through this reconciliation process.
These were girls who were coming from what would have been known as the former communist bloc nations of Ukraine, Moldova, Romania, and they were being brought in and physically migrating in some cases, but mostly being brought in by organized criminals who were colluding both with local nationals in Bosnia as well as internationals who had come in who had the money and were able to facilitate this.
I think what's so – this is very disturbing anyways, but when we think about Bosnia, this, of course, is a country that faced genocide, ethnic cleansing, and where rape, of course, was used as a weapon of war. And then you start seeing this other side where, again, women are victimized in this very awful manner. So you witnessed this. You had women that were coming up to you explaining what was going on. What steps were you able to take, or what did you do?
Well, initially, I was doing everything I could to, of course, investigate the crimes. And all of the allegations certainly did not involve internationals, but a few of them did. And when a few of those cases would come through my office, I would go through the internal steps of first to internal affairs and then to the Secretary General's office of the mission, always having doors closed in my face. Many times, mission officials would come into the internal affairs office and physically pull the files and the cases and just make them disappear. So there was just a multitude of different things going on. And toward the end of my time there in the gender office role as head gender officer, I had been promoted after the first year to head gender officer because of my ability to work these cases. But then along with that came more and more cases of international involvement, which wasn't well liked within the mission. So at one point after I began raising concerns about this, I wrote an email to about 50 UN officials, including some government contractor officials who I worked for. And it was really more of an educational email trying to point out the fact of what was going on and trying to educate them that, look, this really needs to stop. We're here to set the example kind of thing. And I was immediately demoted from my position by the United Nations officials who ultimately were the government contractor officials were also working for the UN and in authoritative positions. So they actually demoted me from my position and then 4 months later terminated me from the lesser position because, of course, I continued to make waves about these cases.
That's Catherine Bolkovac, who worked as a United Nations contractor in the Balkans a little over a decade ago. Let's take a short break, and then we'll hear more of her conversation with our contributor, Rebecca Cruz. I'm Suzette Gralat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Our guest this half hour is Catherine Bolkovac, who uncovered a prostitution and human trafficking ring while working as a United Nations contractor in the Balkans during the region's devastating wars throughout the 1990s. When we left off, she said she was demoted and then ultimately terminated for her whistleblowing. She spoke with our contributor, Rebecca Cruz.
So you were fired for standing up for these women and for bringing the situations to light. What was your recourse then? You did go through a legal process at this point.
Yes. Well, most people don't realize how we send contractors, especially contractors who work for the United Nations, to these foreign missions. And ultimately, you are, you know, seconded through a government contractor. Our governments don't send you directly. So there's always a type of smokescreen set up for accountability issues. When I was terminated by this government contractor called Nine Corp, their contract was actually underwritten under the laws of England. They weren't even underwritten under the laws of the United States. So I physically had to pursue my case in an employment tribunal in Southampton, England. It was a 3-judge panel, and this took about a year, year and a half to finally get through. And in the end, I did win. They had to give me a small settlement of about 110,000 British pounds, which didn't really even cover expenses for the 2 or 3 years that I was out of my position. And subsequently were given continuous government contracts since that time. And the same individuals who were involved both in my demotion and termination and throughout this case, and who were found to be actually unreliable witnesses by the tribunal in their findings, were promoted by this company and continue to work on missions around the world to this day.
Very negative consequences, I suppose, in that regard that these people are still involved. But there were perhaps some positive things that came out of this. You did bring to attention the fact that this was going on, and there has been some results.
Yes, and I think that's, of course, been the mainstay of my career for the past 10 years, actually. I've been traveling internationally and speaking at universities, defense departments, police organizations around the world, really educating people on these issues. I wrote a book, besides the film that was produced because of my story. And it really goes into all of these issues because, of course, it was a story about human trafficking. But it really was much more than that. It was about the use of government military contractors or mercenaries in the mission areas. It was about whistleblowing issues. It was about codes of conduct and ethics. So there, you know, are 5 or 6 really hot topic issues that were all kind of put together in my story. So there have been all kinds of initiatives passed. Legislation has been attempted to get passed here in the U.S. to try and hold contractors more accountable when they go to these missions. There's been limited success with that. But there's also been whistleblower organizations come forward who are now keeping more of an eye on these situations, watchdog groups like the Government Accountability Project, the Project on Government Oversight, and, of course, many international organizations who are working with the member states of the United Nations to correct this problem. In fact, I was invited back to the United Nations 2 years ago to speak and do a book signing there. And the film was actually screened at the United Nations as well. And I think that within the next 3 or 4 years, there's going to be some significant changes within the United Nations and some reforms made.
Okay, this has happened in 1999, I believe, and your story came out in the early 2000s, and horrific information, and they did then institute whistleblower protections and try to put some support in place for people like yourselves that are coming out and highlighting these issues, and yet we still do hear that this sort of thing is going on. I think what comes to mind most clearly is the situation in Haiti a couple of years ago, but in all places that there seem to be UN peacekeepers, we seem to hear some of these stories, whether it's trafficking or some other form of sexual exploitation. So is there really something that can be done? You say in the next 4 years, maybe some restructuring, maybe more protections. What can they do?
I'm glad you bring that up. And I think, you know, the main problem, of course, is, yes, indeed, the UN was able to put together a whistleblower policy. And it's certainly not law. It certainly doesn't get followed. And there's certainly, since 2005, when it was implemented, the few whistleblowers that have come forward have not been protected, and numerous others still aren't coming forward out of fear of losing their jobs. So clearly it's not working, and the implementation process is horrible. On the member state side, of course, it's very difficult because of sovereignty issues, including our own here in the United States, with constitutional issues, to get countries to sign on to any kind of legitimate process where efficient and effective and expeditious investigations can be done when these things happen. I mean, clearly, when you're looking at sexual assaults of young girls and women taking place in foreign countries that don't even have a functional government in place, you know, how do we respond to that before the evidence is gone, before the victim is gone, before the perpetrator has been removed? So these are all the issues that still need to be addressed. And there are some pretty significant things taking place right now where many professionals are coming together to look at possibly solving some problems and presenting some solutions to the UN. I'm not at liberty to speak to all of them right now. I am sitting on that panel, and they're going to kick off an initiative here in the next few months, it sounds like. But there are some things going on to try and get some of that accountability removed and to hopefully lift peacekeeper immunities within these missions for sexual violence.
Your activism then has continued. You're still working to bring attention to this, and it sounds like very involved at multiple levels to hopefully ameliorate the situation. Now, you mentioned that you had a movie, or a movie came out about you, and then you also wrote a book. And I think it's interesting if you could talk just briefly about the difference between having a film that's Hollywoodized about a situation and then what really happened, what the differences are that people might find in your book that they won't find in the film.
Right. Well, the film is called The Whistleblower, and it stars Rachel Vice. She portrays me. It also has Vanessa Redgrave, David Strathairn, and some pretty top actors and actresses in it. It was an excellent film. The director did an excellent job of getting a very strong message out about human trafficking and government corruption in the UN missions and kind of how this all facilitates and plays on each other around the world. There are some major differences in the film and the book. They're two separate projects. Like I said, the film was inspired by my story. So I am a real character in the film, portrayed by Rachel. And Madeline Reese is also portrayed in the film. But all the rest of the characters are very much composite characters and fictional characters. But they're based pretty much on true stories that took place. The film director and writer traveled Europe for a year and a half, 2 years, interviewing victims, interviewing NGOs, interviewing government officials. So this is a very factual account portrayed fictionally. The book, on the other hand, goes much further into the details of the government contractor, the organized crime that was taking place, and the whistleblowing issues that I had to face, as well as the human trafficking, codes of conduct, and ethics issues. They're both great projects. Of course, the book is being used at universities and institutions around the world now as a teaching tool, and I'm quite proud of that as well.
Catherine Balkovac, thank you so much for being here, and thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Rebecca Cruz's conversation with Catherine Balkovac, whose story of uncovering prostitution and human trafficking among United Nations aid workers in Bosnia was told in the 2010 movie The Whistleblower. You can watch the film's trailer on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is produced by KGOU and the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Sam Dupre prepared the web build-out, Brian Hardzinski produces the show, and Symphony Swift works as our research fellow. For Joshua Landis and Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Grelott.